Hey, welcome to Disrupt by Design, our talk show where we talk about design, disruption, digital technology, and transformation. This is JJ De La Torre. I'm a partner and the lead digital transformation for Virtus Partners. And with me is Anat Hoffman. Anat, how are you?
Hi, JJ. I'm very happy to be here. Very excited about recording our first episode ever of Disrupt by Design. And this will be the first of many.
Absolutely. We're disrupting design. We're disrupting from Chile to the world. We're broadcasting live from Chile. And today I'm very happy to announce that we have Rob Hamblin. Rob, how are you?
Hey, JJ. Hey, Anas. How are you guys?
Very good. Very good. How's the weather over there?
Miserable. It started raining all day today.
Yes, yeah, so while we are in South America, in Chile, Rob is enjoying Europe out of Berlin. Tell us something about the Berlin today.
So Berlin actually is really nice and cool. It's been very, very hot here the last month or so. So I may be kind of sounding like I'm complaining about the weather and the rain, but actually it's really refreshing right now.
So it's very good to have Rob with us. We worked with Rob together a few years ago when I was at IBM. We're both, you know, pushing design as a tool to transform organizations and transform businesses. And from there, Rob, maybe you want to give us a little bit of what has been your journey so far and where are you today?
Yeah, that's a really good one, JJ. So so I've been designing for about 25 years. So that's actually gives you a little clue as to kind of my age. But I am actually in Berlin because I moved here to work for a very small agency where we specialized in running design sprints. And I was there for a couple of years, maybe nearly three, actually. And what I've done this year, of all years, is decided to set up my own company called Leap. And here in Europe, Leap is aiming to disrupt by design for companies, varying companies, startups, corporations. And we're in our very first year during, should we mention the dreaded C word that's kind of like given everybody a lockdown this year. But actually, I have to say, The Leap has really taken off beyond my wildest comprehension with regards to kind of the state of the world at the moment. So my background is design thinking and design sprints, and actually a traditional designer as well. So kind of like getting my hands dirty on actual products as well. So when I say traditional design, I mean by like app design. So I've been kind of specializing in mobile and digital design since 2003. So yeah, kind of designing mobiles way before the iPhone was released. So maybe that's enough of an intro for me. Maybe you can, if you need to delve into more, otherwise the whole podcast will just be my intro and I don't want that to happen, so.
No, I think that it's good that you're sharing your experience. I'm happy to see you, you know, jumping into an entrepreneur by design now. As I was saying, I'm very happy to have you in our first episode because Rob, for me, is one of the best designers out there that is actually combining a business with design to actually transform organizations. You were quite of the first one on adopting design sprint and really, you know, spearheading with this new methodology to the world, actually. Like you have been, you know, working in Europe, in America, in Asia, like you have been taking, you know, this methodology to probably like geographies that were never explored before in terms of design. So very happy to have you with us. And you were mentioning design, you were mentioning that you have been a designer and as every design you have been evolving, but maybe we can start with, you know, what is design for you? What means design?
Good question, JJ. I mean, design for me is designing, is giving people the kind of the functionality to kind of get to grips with something new with very little friction. So you're kind of providing them kind of an experience, if you were, especially in our kind of digital like app world. Design is just giving them the best experience possible. And, you know, it goes beyond aesthetics. It's actually about, you know, what the product means for them, what it looks like, and actually how they interact with it as well. So for me, yeah, design kind of encompasses all of those things. And obviously, you know, that's not enough for those of you who are kind of making products out there. You know, that's not enough to kind of hang a business model on. You know, design also should be enabling these people to fulfill their dreams or objectives, whatever it is they're doing, and with as very little friction as possible.
So I love the fact that you mentioned the word enabling, because, you know, I believe that one of the key roles of a designer, it's to actually, you know, understand the organization, understand the end user, understand the problem, and somehow enable, you know, a solution to emerge from the chaos somehow. But what do you think is the role of a designer between these? Like, what we define already what is design, but who is a designer?
Yeah, that's another. This is actually bubbling a lot up a lot in Europe as well at the moment, because, you know, I've worked with many really talented and creative people. But for me, and especially for the last like 6 or 7 years, since like when we were at IBM as well, JJ, for me, you know, if I'm hiring a designer, for example, they need to be more than just a creative. So a designer these days has, they have so much more responsibility on their shoulders to actually understand business. Like, that's one of my kind of primary requirements. And certainly running sprints or any other particular workshop, if you have designers that are in those workshops and they're having communications, like open communications with stakeholders, they need to be able to have good conversations, which actually will enable them faster. So yeah, business is obviously, you know, understanding that is a kind of prerequisite from my side of things. And certainly when I'm hiring at Leap, this is something that I'm kind of like looking into those kind of creative people and just understanding, you know, how they're able to processize their work and actually how they're able to kind of translate those business needs into kind of creative solutions. So what I mean by that could be, you know, for example, if you're a designer, or, you know, you have a new product, maybe you have a website, and, you know, you're recruiting designers to kind of, you know, make feature enhancements, you know, they should be asking the questions, you know, rather than just the aesthetics. They should be asking, like, why, you know, why there's a need for a designer at the moment. And it could just translate to something as simple as, you know, the previous or existing product, maybe the call to actions are maybe hidden, for example. Maybe there's an incurrent amount of scrolling that's needed before you actually, you know, realize that there's an action there that you need to, you know, to kind of press. And really, the designer should be kind of really asking the questions about, you know, like, why, you know, why it's like that in the first place. And it could just be that, you know, by moving a call to action so it's more prominent within an actual digital experience might lead to, you know, like a longer engagement. Maybe you have people actually using the product longer, or actually the conversion of those prospective clients is actually higher because, you know, there's less friction there for them. So business for me is, as a designer, is really, really important. And also, you know, you're very familiar with the Venn diagram, with the, you know, the feasibility, viability. I've just forgotten the other one. but the Venn diagram.
Desirability.
Thank right? you. Desirability. Yeah. Thank you, Anna.
That's the most important one. Huh? If people don't want to have your products, you know, you will not be a very good designer.
Exactly. But, you know, the viability of a product as well, like, you know, is obviously super important. But actually the feasibility, you know, as well as these business discussions, they should be having a really good understanding of how these products are going to be made as well. And I'm not saying that every designer needs to be a coder, but they need to kind of understand the ramifications of the interfaces that they're designing, how are they going to be made, for example? So, you know, if you're building an app and it's multi-platform, you know, how does that experience translate across both of those platforms so that, you know, you're delivering a consistent experience? So, you know, being a designer these days, you have to understand business and you have to understand and be able to communicate to developers as well.
So you know, that's a lot of to be asking from someone, you know, like pretty much you need to be able not only to create and understand the end user, but also understand how to make it possible and be able to actually lead a team that will need to build it. And if we kind of like double click in that point, we often see with the evolution of design and designing as a career, designers that tend to be you know, very creative and stay in the creative side and become kind of like you know, I just create, I'm a creative, you know, I'm somehow, you know, completely isolated from the business reality. Or we see the other extreme where designers, you know, stop designing, you know, become more like a business analyst or a business developer rather than you know, someone that it's really able to design. How to actually manage these two extremes that we see so often in our industry?
Yeah, it's a really tough one for sure. And I think it just comes down to how you enable those people. And I mean, I am a creative by heart. So I will always be driving kind of the creative kind of standpoint into a product. And, you know, that also means, you know, understanding how our users are going to be using these products as well. But I would say it's a tough question because I'm kind of slightly biased to that kind of creative kind of persuasion. So I will always embark upon like new engagements to kind of really steer that creative kind of, you know, direction right from the beginning, and then be able to enable, you know, like, for example, you know, with the people that I work with at Leap, they know that the creative kind of standpoint is really important. So they kind of, they have this kind of autonomy to kind of really kind of, you know, run with that. But, you know, going to kind of corporations, you know, like to mention, you know, like the IBM experiences that we kind of went through, there's a fine line between, you know, having, you know, enough creativity or, you know, just giving the kind of people the freedom to be able to kind of really start those projects with that creativity in their mind without it being kind of compromised as like a consultant almost. So yeah, it's really tough. I'm not sure if I answered the question, but it's a very interesting conversation for sure. Maybe back at you on that one.
So a designer needs to be creative?
Absolutely.
A designer needs to have a good business acumen and understand business?
Yeah.
What about technology?
Yeah, technology as well. Like, so anyone who's really listening to this kind of podcast already, thank you very much. Good on you. but you're already understanding that, you know, there's a lot of responsibility on the kind of the designer's shoulders. But this is where, like in an ideal scenario, when you are a designer working on a project, you're not the only one. So, you know, in an ideal solution, you know, situation, there will be, you know, two or three of you, which means that some of these responsibilities can be kind of shared across those design teams. And, you know, that's when you're probably getting the most effective and efficient kind of way possible. And it just means that, you know, for any of your designers that you talk to on a day-to-day basis, JJ, you know, they'll always say that, you know, collaboration with designers is when they're the most creative. But that's not to say that they don't play well with others. That means that, you know, they can have consultants and, you know, they can have, you know, researchers, they can have project managers and, you know, be able to kind of have conversations with those people. And for me, you know, take Sprint, for example. Yes, it's just one process, but this is kind of where everything kind of that we've spoken about so far is kind of pulled in and kind of magnified as a kind of skill set requirement from that designer, because this is what enables them to be very good sprint designers, because they can kind of juggle all these balls, you know, with desirability, viability, and feasibility. You know, they're essential kind of ingredients into kind of what makes their kind of compelling experiences.
And before we jump into, you know, talking more about the methodologies and how we actually do all this magic, what would be the difference in your words between designing a product or a service and designing a business?
Ooh, good question. You mean with regards to the process or something else?
It's an open question. You can take it from a process perspective, from a skill set perspective, from a vision, a focus, time.
Yeah.
It's really
the easiest way for me to probably to address that is, again, mentioning sprint, because, you know, you can be a designer or a UX designer on a sprint team, and it could just be that you are, like, any one of those two outcomes could be an outcome. Like, it doesn't always have to be, you know, something digital, quite often that it is. But for example, you know, I've worked on many kind of new startups, and, you know, in order for them to be successful as a business, it might be that, you know, for example, the landing page on their website has to be established. So it's very kind of gray area, because I think as a designer, you will already know kind of the ingredients of things that will work, that will enable like that company to be more successful. If it's a product, you will also know what's likely to be needed as an experience within that product for that product to be more successful, which in turn will then make that company more successful. So for me, you know, this also goes back to digital transformation and design thinking as well. It doesn't have to be a sprint, but the common denominator through all of these kind of service experience is that you have to have a firm understanding of, you know, business and the product in order for it to be successful as a designer.
But that understanding, it's what's the horizon of that? Like, in other words, you design for today or you design for tomorrow?
Where have I heard that before? So yeah, actually, I was waiting to drop that in. That's one of my catch lines. I actually always have this kind of this little strap line, especially when, you know, I'm talking to clients and they're a little bit scared of disrupting. They want to kind of maybe make an impact, but they are almost a little bit apprehensive about kind of, you know, how far they should kind of push their product or idea, or just to be a bit safe, you know. And my theory is, you know, as a designer and even anyone on a product, have in mind that the minute you design for something today, you stagnate. You are just literally copycatting any other app that's out there. You are just kind of literally kind of ticking a box that enables it to go to market properly very quickly. My theory is, don't design for today, design for tomorrow. And then the reality of you getting that to market means that, yes, there may be some features or functionalities that you maybe have to kind of claw back on to kind of make that a little bit more grounded, but you're still pushing an evolving design and, you know, you're able to kind of actually make a bigger disruption within that space. So I'm a kind of firm believer that, you know, the minute you are in a brief and someone just says, yeah, like, you know, we want to just like tweak this a little bit and, you know, we want to be a bit safe, they're not really ever planning on being cutting edge. They're just planning on fitting something in to the landscape that doesn't really kind of jump out that much. And actually, a lot of conversations I've been having at the moment, so there's a book actually that I always encourage my designers to read, and that is actually Blue Ocean Strategy. And that means that you can, you know, you're kind of very able to kind of understand the differentiator of a product in order to enable you to kind of target that product, that new product, to be different from everything else. So with the whole kind of, you know, metaphor of the blue ocean, the blue ocean is where a new company that's aiming to disrupt will operate without any competition whatsoever. Whereas the red ocean is like, you know, imagine everybody's fighting for the last little snack of a fish or whatever. So you're aiming for that kind of that blue ocean. And the same is with design as well. Like, you know, you want to aim to be different. You want to push those boundaries. You want to be able to kind of really evolve how those experiences, you know, how those experiences lend themselves to those users. And you have to constantly challenge the, you know, the status quo. And a good example of that actually is a bank here in Europe, N26. And, you know, they're a really new bank. They're completely digital. And they completely changed the way that users are actually onboarded into their product by a video call. And if you imagine, like, you know, five, six years ago, you know, if you'd gone into like a regular bank, they would have just gone like, no, it has to, you have to be here in person. I have to see your passport. And, you know, they've pushed the boundaries of what that experience is in order to qualify and more reliably, more legit people. So, but at the convenience of their mobile from wherever they are in the world. So really, really fantastic. So that's just one example of how, you know, that their metaphor was, okay, how far can we push this experience? And how far can, you know, we really, you know, especially even within Germany, and you have Datenschutz and, you know, all this kind of now, you know, emphasis on people's data and security, to kind of push that through in somewhere like Germany is completely revolutionary within itself. So, you know, they are a disruptor here within Germany, and, you know, they're moving on to really like amazing things. So, I mean, that's just one example.
So, Rob, can you tell us more about how do we actually do this in order to disrupt your market or your value proposition? How do organizations actually make this happen? What's the process, and how these methodologies you were talking about, design thinking and design sprint, take a role in this process?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, there are the design sprint. I was actually only researching the other day. You know, it's been since the original book from Jake, it was 2016. So it's not really been around this long. And, you know, I think there is going to be a lot of people with a lot of opinions saying that, you know, oh, we were always disrupting, you know, I've heard that so many times. So the sprint does enable, you know, companies to move much more quickly. You know, coming from a design thinking and design sprint background, you know, it's really, you know, it's not really, for me, it's not like one or the other. They both kind of complement each other, and they're both kind of like, they kind of have this kind of position with regards to, you know, the complexities of the challenge that needs solving. But with regards to the design sprint in particular, it does enable companies to move, I would say, in my experience, much faster than design thinking. There has to be a kind of like some ground rules though for that statement, to kind of just, you know, not offend people, because, you know, I think with design thinking, you know, that has as much of a place to kind of disrupt. It just does it at a slightly different pace, you know. And I have conversations with, you know, colleagues that work at IDEO. Obviously JJ and I, we used to work at IBM, so we've seen, you know, design thinking be effective. But with the challenges that I've helped companies solve with design sprints, they would not have been able to have been solved that quickly. So I think it just comes down to, you know, the alignment, the actual process itself, if you look at design sprints, you know, the alignment is kind of one of the biggest takeaways from how it's able to disrupt, because it forces, you know, these participants into, you know, a workshop environment for 2 whole days. And, you know, with the companies that I've run sprints for, you know, these are really senior stakeholders, and actually just getting them in the same place for an hour is a pretty big ask. And so that's ultimately where a lot of the disruption comes from, because you're getting these, like, all these brains together, and they're able to kind of align on an agreed kind of way to move forward. And then you have also with the sprint, you have this tangibility aspect, which means, you know, you at the end of 2 days, everybody has an understanding of what the product, you know, kind of blueprint is likely to have. And everybody understands, you know, whether you're coming from an engineering perspective or marketing perspective or even a design or research perspective, everybody has a kind of clear takeaway with regards to how this product is going to be, you know, making an impact in the market. But more importantly, what those company divisions need to do in order to make that product. So, you know, with this tangibility, you know, or prototype, if you want to refer to it in something a bit more, you know, a little bit more friendlier, this prototype just gives everybody the understanding of what this new product is likely to be and how it's going to solve that challenge. And I've always had this kind of theory of, you know, a prototype is not just a visualization of like a complex UX scenarios to kind of guide people through an experience. The prototype actually is just almost like a hard and fast blueprint of all of the decisions that have been made within that workshop. So it means so much more than just, you know, like a walkthrough for a user. I think maybe I would kind of like to have JJ's input on this as well. I feel like I'm doing a lot of the talking at the moment. So maybe it'd be good to have your input, JJ, on something like that.
Yeah, so I think last time we were talking about, you know, alignment and how alignment was so relevant and how you're able to get alignment from managers, from executives, from different persons on our organization, which usually it takes a lot of time for them to actually convey into the same route and align into a path when it's for launching a new product, for establishing a new strategy, or for just deciding what they were not going to invest or do. So I think one of the great, you know, outcomes of this type of methodologies applied is when we get everyone on alignment into that direction, but also we're able to craft somehow how that alignment would look like, how the alignment will be translated into a value proposition and something that can be more tangible than just flat slides that someone can create and project into a meeting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the value proposition there as well, because, you know, this is quite clearly where a lot of products aren't able to disrupt because they actually haven't really defined what their value proposition is. And, you know, that's what these processes enable you to do. And, you know, before you've even, you know, like people have an idea, like this is something that I have in conversation all the time. You know, we're all professionals. We all have an understanding of what we think might work. You know, let's, you know, use the assumption word. Like we all have assumptions because we have that experience, but we don't really have, you know, like we don't have anything really concrete as to whether, you know, this product is going to be successful. And of course, you know, like, you know, I've run like so many sprints, I see patterns forming, of course, but, you know, each challenge has its unique set of parameters which need solving for. But it just means that, you know, when you have these kind of workshops for 2 days, and when you have your prototype within, you know, by the end of the third day, and then when you have it validated by 5 users on the fourth day, you know, this is really, you know, imagine that you actually have answers and data that you can actually use to validate whether that proposition is even the right thing to move forward with. So it's so powerful, like really, really powerful. And I can't actually imagine doing things any differently at the moment. And I know at Leap, you know, the design sprint is kind of like my core product. And I've got variations of that product that enable either startups or corporations to kind of move at slightly different paces. But it's still ultimately, you know, the underpinnings are like that 4-day design sprint. It's just how I kind of package it around it. But it just means that, you know, there's something there for these people. They don't have to invest, you know, months and months of time into kind of building something just to find out that they didn't need to spend that much time and it's maybe not going to work. And, you know, my biggest, I don't have a life of regrets, but my one of my only kind of career regrets is that I didn't know the sprint, or the sprint wasn't accessible to me back in 2009 when I actually co-founded an app. And, you know, we ended up just building too much of it, and we should have just, you know, run smaller sprints to kind of really understand, you know, what bits really resonated with those end users, and, you know, which, and then define which parts of the product were the most complicated, which obviously affected the development cycles. So, you know, back in those days, we ended up just building everything and designing everything, and, you know, obviously it was an amazing product, I'm not going to lie, but we could have just been so much more optimized. And I think this is where, you know, the market for you guys especially, this is where, you know, your clients will be able to be able to move quickly. And I think if they can move quickly, if they can move faster than their competitors, then that's where they're able to kind of be the most disruptive. So I brought it back to the disruption. Yeah. So there you go. I brought it nicely back for you guys. So there was an objective there. But yeah, no, joking aside, that is, you know, if you are able to get ahead of your competition, then you are, it's going to be a much more beneficial advantage for that company to be ahead. And this is a process that enables them to do that very reliably as well.
Rob, so you mentioned earlier that you've many times seen and worked with companies that really want to make a change and do things differently and actually disrupt. But it's also a very scary process, right? And I wanted to ask, how does this process help your clients gain confidence and actually take this step forward and designing for tomorrow, not doing business as usual?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has trepidation before they start a sprint. There's normally one person that's done a little bit of research and they're thinking that this process is going to kind of help them. So typically within, you know, the senior stakeholder team that engages, there's normally somebody that's got a pretty good understanding that it's going to work. You know, bearing in mind, they're likely to still be new to it, but they just know that they have to move fast and this is going to give them some tangible results in days rather than, you know, weeks or months or whatever. The conversations I often have with these people it comes down to like people, when, you know, suddenly when you talk about money, people listen. And, you know, when I throw at them some facts, you know, like, you know, if you're thinking about potentially spending, you know, $250,000 developing a product for, you know, 5 or 6 months or maybe even longer, depending on who the client is, for example, you know, do they need to actually waste all that money in order for them to realize that they are, you know, they're building a product that's just a bit of a dog? Or would they rather invest a couple of weeks, like, you know, using the 4-day design sprint up front to really understand, okay, you know, is this a product that we need, or is it just the right product that we need to build right now? So there's many conversations, and unfortunately, I think this podcast doesn't allow us even enough time to have those conversations. But typically, I would just say that it comes down to money, and it comes down to, you know, they can relate to that. And I think, you know, once you quote figures at them for like their normal development cycles, and then when you mention how kind of fast and lean a sprint is, they're already doing the workings that it's a no-brainer. And, you know, something else that I would also like to stress is that, you know, everybody has in their minds, like, you know, oh yeah, we want you to fail. Like, we want you to fail fast and so we can learn from that. I think most companies don't really know how to fail. They want to say those words, but they know that failure ultimately is accredited to time and money. And, you know, they'll be smiling, but kind of like behind their, you know, their grin, they'll be going, oh, you know, this is going to cost a fortune and, you know, we're not really learning anything. But the design sprint actually enables you to fail fast so that you don't actually waste time. And, you know, some of you might be thinking now, well, you know, like, okay, so you run a design sprint, you know, and the product crashes and burns after the first week, you know, that was a waste of a week. And that's great. And it wasn't like a ton of time, but actually it's not just a week. You have also collected data from your potential demographics who are using that product. So even, and quite often the patterns that we see at Leap are that, you know, you have these companies that come in, you run on these assumptions, you materialize a product and then you test it. And then, you know, there's a lot of negative data, you know, within that fourth day of like how this product is performing. But what I often say is that it's better to know that negative data there, because then you can actually act on it, or in business terms, you can pivot on it and then maybe find out where that business model is failing and introduce new parameters and which kind of correct that. And that's also where you can also be a bit more disruptive, because you're able to kind of act on that data. But it's more about just, you just know, it's better to know where the land lies with regards to, okay, we know now what not to do. And within that, it actually gives you this perspective of, okay, now we know what we can do, and we have hunches now and data that we can now actually move forward and mitigate a lot of that risk. And actually, that's why often, you know, Leap offers iteration sprints, because this means that you can actually act on that data for the second week. You're then able to, you know, I take a lot of pride in the fact that, you know, I just don't want to go in and tell a company that their product's failing or the product's working and then leave them to it. It's more about actually guiding them through on this process as well. So if you can actually help them digest and synthesize that data that they've you know, suddenly have so quickly, we're actually also then able to run another series of workshop process kind of orientated tasks to then redefine what the prototype will look like on a week two, and then retest it again with another five users. And by that time, you're already correcting a lot of that negative data into something that actually is more meaningful for them. So there's a lot that can be kind of taken away from that. So hopefully that answers your question.
Let me try to add something to that there, Rob, because I think that I agree with everything that you said, but it requires certain level of maturity from the client side to be able to capture some of the concepts that you mentioned. In particular, the failure. You know, most of our clients, when they start a new endeavor or when they start a new project, they want to succeed, and they only have success in their mind. The possibility of failure is not even on the horizon, and the organizations are not prepared to capture failure as a learning option or as a way to actually improve the product or whatever endeavor they're doing. And I think that this somehow, trying to avoid failure at all costs, prevent many companies, in particular in Latin America, for pushing more innovation, for being more daring, from really becoming more aggressive in terms of reshaping their markets or questioning their value proposition. We tend to see many clients that stick to their old value propositions. Besides, they already know that the clients don't want them, and they're not consuming those value propositions as they were doing 5-10 years ago. But the inability to actually see failure as a learning component for an organization and have to fail in the process of creating a product prevent them to actually innovating and pushing it forward.
Yeah, I mean,
this is a difficult question for you, Rob.
It's a really, how you take that conversation as well, because quite often what I will say to those companies and to companies that I also engage with is that if they don't really make an allowance to fail like upfront, then it's going to cost them a lot of money down the line. Because we hear it all the time, companies like they don't want to do user testing because they feel like, you know, it's a lot of effort to go to find those actual targeted users. And then obviously you have to kind of capture all that data. And then obviously, you know, by this time, build cycles or development cycles are already in place. So, that, you know, they feel like, if it's already being made, like how can we like change things? It's going to just cost us too much time. But through my experience, companies that don't do that, they end up, maybe you might release a product on time and you've built it completely on your assumptions and pat on the back for everybody because you've got a product that's now going out the door. But basically, the elephant in the room is that, it's a product that no one really wants to use. And if they just done some mitigation up front with regards to, putting it in front of users or even, try, I liked how you mentioned the innovation side of things, JJ, because, how do you know if you're truly innovating if you don't try new things? If you just replicate the same things all the time, you're not really, this goes back to the, design for today, you're just, copying what your competitors are doing. Whereas if you really want to truly innovate, embrace a process that enables you to really like try something really quickly and then understand whether it's going to fail. And I have this kind of little storytelling scenario when companies are about to book sprints with me. And that is that, I also want to clear up. So I run a 4-day sprint. Okay. And this is encompassed in over 2 weeks. And that what that means is that, you know, we are able to run a 1 week sprint. And so one day, so cut this bit out, this is really bad. And you're trying to, you know, you're running a sprint on the first 4 days, and then you're iterating again for the next 4 days. Yeah. And what that means is the first sprint, you're actually going wide. I encourage our clients who are participating, the product team that I work with, encouraging them to go wide. Like, this is where the innovation is. This is, we have a challenge. How can we solve it? But how can we solve it in a way that's really, you know, not that conventional? How can we be really disruptive? How can we really find that blue ocean, you know, in the whole blue ocean strategy? So week one is about kind of going wide. And, you know, what that means is that, yeah, you're likely to overshoot your target. And, you know, your dev team are probably a little bit nervous because they're thinking, well, you know, this stuff's kind of crazy, wacky, but, you know, like, we're never going to kind of make that. That's actually completely fine. And, you know, you might also find that there's a dev team that are motivated to kind of designing and building something that's slightly different and breaks away from their norm. But what happens is that, you know, once you've kind of lifted the barriers for everybody to be able to go, do you know what? Let's really think about this. Let's really think about what it could be. This is when you get the best out of everybody. Okay. And then on the second week, the iteration sprint that I mentioned earlier, you know, this is where, you know, you would only have a 1 day workshop on the second week rather than the 2 day workshop on the week one. On the iteration workshop, this is where we kind of revise and focus. So, okay, we learned from the last week, we learned from the product that we put in front of those five users that, yeah, do you know what? It was a bit too wacky. Maybe they're not quite ready for this just yet, but 70% of it actually was pretty good, and actually we can build that at the moment. It's just that extra 30%, which is maybe, you know, a crazy wacky USP that was kind of like there just to try and pull them in. Maybe things like that have to be de-scoped, but what it means is that you're then able to claw back some reality into a product that is more likely to be more well received. So this is the revise and focus. So this is about kind of like really kind of focusing in on, okay, now what can we build based on the data, and what do our users actually really want? So to come back to the question, which was, you know, about, you know, how do we kind of enable companies to understand that failure, you know, it is okay, and it isn't going to cost them money. The design sprint will actually help them factor in that, do you know what? With this new product that they're about to build, with this new way that their company is going to be perceived in this market that's never been done before, yeah, there is risk. And if you don't plan to fail up front, then it's likely that the product that you'll release is just going to drag its heels and, you know, not be very well received by the users. Or it could just be that, you know, everybody puts all their eggs in one basket with regards to this is the perfect product, and everybody's then too stubborn to acknowledge that things need to be changed on it. So yeah, I mean, I think this is probably for Europe and kind of like the, you know, Northern Hemisphere. We're finding actually that, you know, the design sprint is becoming an enabler for these companies, so they can mitigate that risk of not trying things out, because it could just be that the thing that they want to try, they've been scared to do that before. The design sprint is just a way for them just to kind of really try that very quickly without any risk whatsoever.
Great. So Rob, we are sadly reaching the end of this session, but in order to wrap up, I wanted to ask you why, while disrupting businesses, value propositions, products, services, good design makes the difference.
Yeah, I'll try and not go too long-winded on this, because this is a through part of my experience. I really love answering this question. And good design, you know, a lot of companies might just think, wow, you know, like, you know, we feel like we're doing UX because the color of that button is this color and, you know, our users can click it. You know, that's a really good step in the right direction to kind of making, you know, a good difference with design. And, you know, obviously JJ, you know, and I, when we were at IBM, it's all about the experience, which is great. But I really want to tell a story about a particular client, and I'm not going to say when or where it happened, because, you know, they were a really amazing client actually. Initially, they didn't really value what design meant, and they didn't. It was all money. It was like, okay, you know, design was a commodity. Design was just something that they had to do because, you know, their competitors were doing it, but they didn't really understand like the value of why design or good design makes a difference. So when I originally took the brief from this very senior client, he basically just said to me that he wanted the same product as his competitor, who was in a completely different industry. So he loved this other product because it was like winning awards, you know, because people respected it, because blah, blah, blah. You know, you all the things that you would, you know, say when you're trying to go, oh yeah, look at this, this is really cool. And then when I tried to kind of reframe it, that actually that product wouldn't be good enough for the challenge, you know, to solve the challenge that he had, he was like a little bit kind of, you know, well, like, what do you mean? Like, I don't really understand. Like, if this is doing well, then we just want this, you know, this is exactly what we want. So I had to have this conversation with him about, you know, it's about, you know, carving your own groove, and, you know, you have a different challenge, and we have to address different users, and we have to do, you know, so many things. And eventually kind of persuaded him. But something I've just missed out, which I've just realized, is that he briefed me and just said that he wanted this product, he wanted his product to win awards. And that was the only thing that mattered to him, because like his competitor was winning awards as well. And for me, it was like, okay, this is kind of a tricky scenario, because, you know, like, I'm now about to tell this brand new client, I'm in a new role, that I'm not really listening to him. And that, you know, that the awards thing was kind of superfluous, and it shouldn't really ever be his focus. But what I did say to him was all of those things, but in a very diplomatic way, that actually his focus should be for the end user who is going to be using his product, and how this product and this experience is actually going to change people's lives, because it was in healthcare. So obviously it's going to make a bit of a difference to people's lives. And when I'd kind of finished that conversation with him, I know that the team that were also there, that we came out of the meeting room, is like, whoo, you know, that was a tough one, you know, and like, you know, wow, that was a tough conversation. And, you know, how was it? How did he take it? And it was one of those calculated risks that I actually knew it would be okay. A, because I knew that I knew what, like, my skill set and how I could influence the team to kind of deliver him what he wanted. That wasn't a problem at all. The problem was this mindset of just winning awards. And I had to be kind of super arrogant in that position to just say that it didn't matter and that we would just win them anyway. And I didn't tell the team that. I just said that, you know, forget about the awards, they will come later, we will win. And I actually said to him that we would win that award. And, but I didn't tell the team until actually after we'd won it. And they were all like, I can't believe you promised that at the end of that. But it was more about kind of skewing the perspective of what was important to him. And I just said to him that once you have those users and they believe in the product and they believe in this experience and how it's going to help them, the users will speak for themselves and then the awards will just follow. It was a natural kind of progression for me. And that's, for me, why good design makes a difference, because you're able to kind of build these experiences so that people can really believe in, you know, the product that's being offered to them, and in a lot of cases actually really embellish and enhance their lives, because you're, you know, through digital mediums, you're actually able to you know, make people's lives a lot easier, because obviously, you know you're removing a lot of the analog kind of pain points, and streamlining it in a digital way that enables people to spend less time doing that task. I was going to say spend less time on their phone, but you're ultimately wanting to relieve them from the task so they can spend more time on their phone on social medias. So so that's, for me, like the story that I always say. And actually, we did win that award for both products 2 years consecutively, and I believe they still went on to continue to win awards for that. So yeah, it just goes to show.
Great, yeah, amazing. I love that take on, it's actually about changing lives, or like how users they relate to their environment, and it's, at the end of the day, is to make their lives better, right?
Yeah, exactly. And for businesses to make money, don't forget that as well. So yeah, Yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, yeah. And actually for me, this is where, you know, I pull in now because I have the design thinking and the design sprint kind of processes like ingrained into my DNA. I'm able to then also pull in some more of the empathy up front because, you know, the design sprint is such a cold process. It kind of pulls people in and spits people out. It doesn't really kind of factor in empathy up front. And this is what now I try and do. So when I run my sprints, I will talk to those potential users and I will like delve into the realms of design thinking and try and find out, you know, where they are having their pain points. And what that means is that when we go into a design sprint workshop, we have way more than just assumptions. We're kind of preloading the workshop with actual upfront data from the user and empathy. So as much as I'm, you know, geared to kind of getting the end user through these digital experiences, I'm acutely aware as well that these companies, they also have to make money and, you know, in order to survive and build the next iteration of this product. So yeah, it's a win-win for everybody, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's quite interesting how as we're getting to the end of this first episode, and thanks, you know, Rob, for being part of it, we go back to the very beginning of it, you know, with empathy, with understanding, you know, how to put the user at the center, and I would say that most important, how design can really help companies to achieve higher goals through empathy and through crafting products and services that suits their customers, their clients, and not just, you know, from has been created from a pure perspective from the company. So at the end, we're rounded with empathy, and we're ending with empathy, starting from the user and ending with the user.
Yeah, I love that. Rob, before saying goodbye, I would like to have your input on this last section of our podcast called Your Three Musts. So we can tell our listeners what to read, where to listen to, what to watch if you want to know more about design and disruption.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it goes without saying that follow Leap on Instagram and LinkedIn. Follow us at, it's actually Be The Leap. Instagram is kind of a new thing. Sorry, not Instagram. LinkedIn is kind of the new platform for us that we're kind of building up. So we're slowly getting momentum there, and we're slowly switching from kind of my kind of profile on LinkedIn to Be The Leap. So yeah, if you can give us some support there, that would be really great. I have like a handful of books that I will recommend, and these are either books that I hand out to like my new employees, or books that I would just recommend to people who want to just know how to advance like their product strategy. And the first one is obviously Design Sprint, written by Jake Knapp. So definitely give that a read if you haven't already. And there's also a ton of, you know, different, you know, kind of blogs out there with regards to the GV Sprint, the Google Sprint, and the one that Jake was involved in. But essentially, it's a good, if you're completely new to it, it's a really good kind of like discovery book, because you'll really understand like where it originated from and originally why it was 5 days. And then you'll kind of appreciate why I was then going into like the 4 day sprint during our conversations. The next one I would recommend is Hacking Growth. This is also really good for anyone who is working and wanting to kind of strategize about how to kind of make their products or companies perform more optimally. And this is a really great book. There's loads of really great insights from companies that have already, you know, gone through this. And, you know, for example, you know, like the Dropbox scenario, all these strategies where they were like tried and tested back in the day. And I also have another one called Blitzscaling as well. So for those companies that are wanting to create new products to kind of really, you know, scale you know, exponentially, Blitzscaling is also a really, really good book. And there's also a ton of like case studies in there where you get to kind of be a bird's eye view on how these companies were ruthlessly scaling just to kind of keep up with the demand. So that they're really good ones, and for certainly for product strategy, and you know, as young or new consultants or designers or UX designers, they're also really good books. You know, my theory is if you're a designer, don't limit yourself to just the typography books and, you know, how to make things beautiful. You really need to kind of know some of these more kind of business orientated kind of findings as well, and you know, present those to yourself as well. And I actually also co-present my last three musters that I also co-present a podcast here. It's already on the App Store, and I think we are pushing it to other mediums at the moment. But this is called All About the Product. And this is something where my other co-producer, he comes from design and product, but from actually not design. He comes from product from a different perspective. I bring the design, and he kind of brings like the process and the kind of the management side of things. And we quite often have just chats comparing, you know, kind of our experiences from all the products that we've made and the processes that we use, but we kind of look at it from two different perspectives as well. So yeah, I mean, it's not as slick as this podcast, I would say. Definitely, you know, this is a really good and very well recorded and very professional my podcast. I'm super honored to be your first guest. You know, I hopefully we'll follow in your footsteps with regards to how you're executing on your podcast. So great stuff, guys. And thanks so much.
We're super honored to have you as our first guests. So thank you very much for everything, Rob. And hope to have you again when we grow more for more interesting conversations.
Yeah, no, I think we just scratched the surface today as well. So I think there's so much that this conversation is not over, let's just say.
Yeah, and to our listeners, stay tuned, and we're going to be coming back with another guest as interested as Rob. So thanks a lot for listening, and stay tuned.